man with the game information. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Xbox, Nintendo, PC, or PlayStation. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Giving the news to the nerd generation. Game and Steve. Give me news.
Give me news.
Give me views.
Give me views.
Game and Steve.
Game and Steve. He got the game.
What's to see?
What to see?
What to me?
Put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one-man vortex of gaming information, the man who is Gordon Freeman's thesis advisor at MIT. Ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey, and welcome to Gaming Steve, the home of intelligent game discussion. I'm your host, Stephen Glicker, and in this week's show, we go through all the latest gaming news. I sit down and interview Randy Bueller, the Vice President of Digital Gaming at Wizards of the Coast, where we talk all about Wizards of the Coast Digital Initiative throughout all brands and all games. I then have a retro review of Coltsep for the PlayStation 2, probably a game you've never heard of, but if you love Magic the Gathering, you'll love this game. I then have the Name That Game contest, where I'm giving away a free next-generation console. I'll tell you how that's going. Then we have Show Mail, where I answer your questions, and then Final Thoughts. So it's been nice to be back on the site, as you probably have seen. It's been updated quite a bit, trying to get it back. We got mentioned on Kotaku and a few other places for one of the stories, which really was a nice boost of hits to the site. It's always been pretty popular, especially since the forums are so active. But, you know, it's always nice to come back with some vigor. And the other thing I've been doing is going through the applications, because as I forgot, the site and the show take up a huge amount of my time, and already it's starting to strain what free time I have. For instance, I can't get any video games played, and since this is a site about video games, it's hard for me to talk about them if I can't play them. So people have applied for positions for the site, for helping to contribute to the site on the front page. But if you're interested, send me an email at feedback@gamingsteve.com. It's a non-paid position, but I'll send you back an application. And right now I am culling through and going through a couple of people who submitted some. There's a little bit more feedback I need to get from them, but we're going to start narrowing it down and have other people posting on the site very soon. We're also working on a new update to the design and layout of the site itself. It's actually been designed as sort of a new logo. It's right now trying to find the correct people to implement it, since it's sort of a busy time of year. So we have I have a couple of people I'm working with to implement this correctly. I'm going to do some of the programming, but quite frankly, it is I don't have that much free time to do it. So I'm going to be finding other people who are experts in movable type, as well as Simple Machines Forum, which is our forum software, to implement that. But again, if you're interested in contributing in the site, you know, send me an email to feedback@gamingsteve.com and let me know that you are interested, and I'll send you back an application to see if you got what it takes. But let's get into this week's show.
Gaming news! Gaming news!
So the news is definitely a lot slimmer than last week. Not quite as much, considering you had the Activision Blizzard merger and you had the big brouhaha at GameStop. So, but I found a couple of interesting tidbits here and there, and I'm going to talk about the GameStop at the end of the news, but let's go through the rest of the news. First up, we have an interesting item here, as that Wedbush Morgan Securities analyst Michael Pratchard believes that the hardware sales for the Xbox 360 are going to rival and come very close to the sales for the Nintendo Wii because they can't meet supply. He goes on to explain that he believes that Microsoft will sell about 1.5 million Xbox 360s this December in the United States. Nintendo will sell 1.7 million Wiis, and Sony will sell about 800,000 PlayStation 3s. He also manages to say that he continues to believe that the PlayStation 2 is going to do much better this year in software sales. It's going to only drop 24%, and they thought it was actually going to drop 32%. So what does this mean? Why is this important? It shows an interesting trend. That's why it's important. It shows that this is interesting thing that happens is when you go in and people need to buy something, I forgot the exact term, it's like brand substitution, is that you go in and you want to go buy a Nintendo Wii. You go into the store, you know, it's what your kids want for Christmas, etc. You go in, you can't find it. You don't have the patience or the tenacity to sit outside and get one. but you know your kid wants something, so you're going to have to get something else. So you have to substitute that brand with something else. And what does that mean? You're going to buy a PlayStation 2, or you're going to buy an Xbox 360, or you're going to buy a PlayStation 3. That's what that means. So, you know, Xbox 360 is really doing a good job of taking advantage of not only their price point, but, you know, having the product out there, having that year sale, you know, having a year of sales before the PlayStation 3, you know, has really helped them quite a bit. Because those sales that they're losing out, the Wii is losing out on, are probably going, they're going to both, but more are probably going to the Xbox 360. There's a few reasons for this. One, the price point. You know, you can get a PlayStation 3 for the same amount as an Xbox 360, but you're getting the lesser version. You're not going to get the full-fledged version. And you know what, consumers, they don't like that. Okay, you might be someone who goes in, it might be a mother of three kids who has no idea what the difference between a PlayStation 3 is and an Xbox 360, but knows value when they see it. And if they see you can get the full-fledged 360 and it has a lot more games and it's the same price as a PlayStation 3, but it's the lesser version of the PlayStation 3, the better one is more expensive and there's less games, etc., you know, subconsciously, they will go for what they think is the better value. And quite frankly, that's actually one of the main reasons why the Wii has been doing so well, is the price point. And, you know, you can say, well, you know, look at the, you know, it's like, well, the PlayStation 3 has better graphics and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? It really doesn't matter to the people that are going out and buying these things. The hardcore people that want a PlayStation 3 because it has better graphics and because of the selection of games, or any game system for that matter, will find it and buy it. They're the ones that will go to GameStop at 6 in the morning and wait outside to get their Wii. You know, they're the ones that will pay any price on eBay. But, you know, parents who are just trying to find something for the kids that they really want and get a nice Christmas present for their, you know, family, they're not going to go through these crazy extremes. They're going to get what they can get that's a good price and feel it's good value. And right now, that appears to be the Xbox 360, as well as Nintendo DS. Now, the PlayStation PSP has actually been doing very well as well with the recent sales. One, because they have the new version, and two, what a surprise, the price point came down. You know, it's amazing what the price point can do when it comes to sales. So, you know, the Xbox 360, they've done a very, very good job of, you know, jumping in and taking, you know, first they were the leaders, and now they're sort of coming in, you know, almost behind, but it's actually, you know, doing really well for them. The PlayStation 3, you know, they just got to bite the bullet. I mean, if they made that thing $250, that thing would be flying off the shelves. And I know they'd be losing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, but, you know, they have to start getting the install base up, because developers, you know, if they're going to develop for that system and they can't recoup their money for what it costs to get these games out, and these games cost a lot more to develop than the Wii or even the 360, you know, it's sort of like a vicious cycle. So, I don't know. We're going to see how the, you know, all plays out. I just think, you know, they really have to do their best, Sony and PlayStation, to really make the PlayStation 3 a viable price option, especially by next year. By next Christmas, they just cannot keep this $400 price point. It will just not hold up. Next, we have Kane and Lynch's site is fibbing about the review scores. So, I thought, again, sort of my background with working with advertising firms, a lot, I found this one fascinating, is that in their, if you go to their website, this is all taken down, if you went to the Kane and Lynch website, past the Flash intro, they had review scores of the game flashed, one from GameSpy and one from Game Informer, where they have a quote and then they have 5 stars. Now, is that a game review? You know, they can say, well, no, that's just not really a game review. That's just sort of just, you know, a graphical treatment. But come on, that's ridiculous. Everyone knows that if you see 5 stars, that means, oh, they gave it 5 stars. For example, GameSpy, it says, it's the best emulation of being in the midst of Michael Mann movie we've ever seen in the review of the game. However, they never said that in a review. They said that in their E3 2007 preview coverage, and they didn't give it 5 stars. They gave it 3 stars, something very similar to Game Informer. They gave him a quote, and they said that they gave him 5 stars, but once again, Game Informer only gave it a 7 out of 10. So, you know, this was all taken down after it was made public. But, you know, this stuff, again, it is, you know, I just don't know what's going on here. It's like Kane and Lynch, they seem to really want to push this game, and they're doing everything in their power to make this into a new, you know, new brand, you know, a new IP brand, intellectual property. They're trying to really, you know, make sales of this game and push it at any expense. But that, I wonder who did that. I mean, I just can't imagine. If it was the advertising agency, they know better. If it was the site directors, they, well, everyone knows better, really. But, you know, there's really no rule against that. I mean, I guess it's false advertising if you do that. But, you know, it's not like they're putting in so much in their advertising. In, you know, they're not buying published advertising, put it in. You know, it's like, it's hard to say, because I'd have to look that up exactly, because it's not like they're exactly claiming that the game will, I don't know, like, cure the common cold or something. It's just showing that this is what other people said. And they could very easily say, oh, sorry, that's a misprint. We just made a mistake. Sorry about that. Here, let's fix that. You know, of course, they can do that a month later. That reminds me of, emails. Often I will, you know, sign up for websites, and I'll often opt out to be on their email lists. And, you know, I won't hear from them all year. And then right around Christmas time, out of coincidence or just out of a, quote, mistake, they will accidentally send me an email from their website showing me, you know, the latest Christmas offerings for the holiday season. And, of course, it's the only time of the year this mistake is ever made. You know, they're very sorry. And then, of course, they'll put me back on their, you know, do not, you know, forward emails to list once again. And once again, they couldn't be any sorrier that they did that. But it's amazing how many sites did this to me on the last few years. It always seems to happen right around this time of year that, you know, they, quote, accidentally make these mistakes. So they were caught red-handed, and I want to see how this gets played out in the next couple of months, years. A boy was attacked by a moose, and he feigns death thanks to World of Warcraft. I don't know if this is true or not. This was all over the wires. A Norwegian news site was saying that a young boy and his sister were attacked by a moose. He then taunted the moose away from his sister and then feigned death, causing the moose to lose interest, or aka lose aggro, and then leave him. And he was quoted to say, quote, just like you learn in level 30 in World of Warcraft, the boy is reported quoting as saying. So who knows if this is true or not. But I will tell you, I actually saw a moose when I was in Alaska, and they are enormous beyond belief. It was like walking next to a car. Actually, I was in a bus, and the moose walked over to us, and, you know, I'm sitting in one of these buses where you're really high up, and I'm looking outside the window, and the moose's eyes were level with mine, and it's like Rack was above the bus. It was enormous beyond belief. So if this is true, that kid has a big set of them, let me tell you. And I'm just happy he didn't get hurt. And I would not suggest anyone tries that in the real world, because I have a feeling there's a 50-50 chance that moose would not just ignore you. Also in the news, GameStop is promoted to the S&P 500. This is a big deal. This is GameStop. I've been following this company ever since it went public. I think it was 2000, 2001, the first went public. It's trading on the stock exchange. The stock just languished at the bottom. It really didn't do anything. It kept going down and down and down. And meanwhile, the store was just making more and more money. I couldn't figure out why people weren't buying the stock. Actually, there were a lot of reasons why. You know, it just wasn't on a lot of buy lists. It wasn't on a lot of trading screens, things like that. And then, you know, slowly, you know, stocks like that just can't be ignored. And then it shot up, and it's been doing, you know, fantastic. I think it's up, about 90, 100% this year alone. And they, because they're doing so well, they actually now on the Standard Poor's 500, which is the list of the top 500 large cap publicly held companies in the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ Stock Exchange. And they actually replaced Dow Jones, which is the Wall Street Journal. So just to give you an idea how far the Dow Jones company itself has fallen, as considering they were considered one of the biggest companies in the world. In fact, if you look at the Dow Jones, which is made up of 30 companies, I believe not a single company when the Dow Jones was originally made over 100 years ago even exists. You know, first, they're not on it anymore, but not a single one of the companies even exists except for one, and I believe that's General Electric. That's the only one that exists. But back then, there was a lot of railroad companies. You could see where those all have gone. You know, there's just a lot of these manufacturing and production companies that just don't we just don't do that in the United States anymore. But it just shows, you know, Dow Jones, one of the most powerful, biggest companies in the world, and now it's no longer even on the S&P 500. And it's pretty amazing since the S&P Dow Jones was bought for $5 billion in August, and now it's been knocked off the, you know, 500 top companies, just to show you how big you have to be to even get on there. $5 billion just doesn't cut it. Marketing Week reported that Nintendo is pulling its Wii ads due to demand. Again, this got a ton of press because it's just unheard of. It's Nintendo is pulling their ads for the holiday season, and they're quoted as saying is that, you know, company said it would be they've been forced to pull the ads because retailers have been running out of the consoles, and it would be irresponsible to continue the campaign. And instead, they're just going to change it to Nintendo DS. But, you know, the Nintendo DS is also pretty hard to find. So, Nintendo, it's, you know, it's pretty rare you see someone actually pull advertising the Christmas season, and I don't know what is going on with them, man. They just cannot get those things in stock. I tell you, in the beginning, if you do what I did, and like in the middle of the summer, you see Nintendo Wii's just around, you might want to buy them, because I don't know if they're going to be able to, you know, continue their manufacturing and to make it enough supply to meet the demand, because it's just going to continue. It's, you know, as more and more games come out, as, you know, they continue to get the systems created, and as more people want it and get exposed to it, because there's so many people who buy the Wii that are not gamers, that are just your average Joe Blow people, and there's a lot more of those than there are hardcore gamers. So I wouldn't be surprised next year if we have very similar stories. Here's a bad one. EVE Online patch accidentally bricks Windows XP. This was horrible. This is really bad. It was actually anyone who was playing EVE Online who used Windows XP and updated their game via the premium Trinity patch before 4 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time. They, if they installed it and restarted the computer, it accidentally overwrote your Windows boot any file and it killed the computer. It wouldn't reboot. So that is bad. That was actually, it was a mistake done in the patcher. And all they did was put an extra little backslash in the install path. And I don't know what happened there. But, you know, a game like that, I mean, here's EVE Online. And that just shows you just how quickly you can lose loyalty in a game. Remember when Star Wars Galaxies completely revamped the game and people went nuts? A lot of the hardcore people left the game. They actually go to stores and deface the boxes. You know, EVE Online, it's a very, you know, a game that's very slowly been growing its fan base. It's been getting bigger and bigger, you know, through a lot of word of mouth, through people, you know, telling other people to play it, through a very well-designed advertising campaign. And then you do something like that, and, you know, here it is. You have this really niche hardcore audience, and you just totally piss them off. I mean, I don't even know how I respond to that. It's like if I, you know, I don't know if you can even really trust them ever again. I mean, I guess on the good side, they're going to make sure they run every single patch and, you know, anything they release through a fine-tooth comb. But at the same time, if that's your computer and you can't get to it, I can see this turning off a lot of people. I've seen people not play video games for less. You know, I've seen a lot of friends of mine who play Diablo 2. They go online, they get killed, and then they never played online ever again. Or even Warcraft 3, for that matter, or even StarCraft. They would just go online, just get destroyed, and they just never wanted to play again. It is a little different since it's an MMO, but still, dude, put that through your QA department a little bit better, especially the patch, the patching program itself. That actually is not uncommon, believe it or not, because a lot of times the QA departments, they're so used to QAing it, they get a little lazy, and then boom, I've seen it happen before. Not to this extent. This is atrocious. Guitar Hero 3 on the Wii is getting new discs in 2008. It was reported a few months ago that Guitar Hero 3 on the Wii was just producing mono sound, and it was not producing true stereo. Again, here's something else. Stunned this went through QA. I'm stunned that no one caught this. I presume, you know, it's something you really just have to listen to. If you have headphones on, you might not even notice it, or if you're even capturing the wave, like the only way they're even to prove it is that they had to output the sound into a, you know, and capture it, look at the wave output and see that the left and right channels match perfectly. And there's no way to really do a live hotfix like you might do on the Xbox 360 or PlayStation 3, because there's just not a lot of capacity on the Wii. So they're going to give out free discs in 2008, no charge, no one knows exactly how this is going to happen, but if you have a Wii and you have Guitar Hero 3 and this is affecting you, be aware of that. I'm really stunned by all these all these mistakes. I tell you, that's also something you see. It's like back in the cartridge days, you know, these games are really tested to death, and it was so rare that you would see these. You know, there'd be like a glitch here and there, maybe a bug, but it's incredibly rare. But nowadays, you know, with hot patches and downloads, you know, I mean, PC games are the worst. I mean, I am always stunned that the day a game comes out, the patch is released at the same time. You know, it's like, here's the game and here's the patch for the game. So, you know, and now it's starting to bleed over to consoles because the consoles are nothing more than justified computers. And the worst part is everyone expects it and is used to it. You know, it reminds me back in the 70s. Remember that? If anyone here who's listening is even born. In the 70s and 80s, you'd actually buy a car. And then the first thing you would do is you'd buy a car and then you would bring it for a tune-up because your car would, it was just assumed that your car would have problems with it because cars are too hard to make. You know, how is it possible that you can buy a car and it's not perfect in every way? So you'd buy the car, then, you know, you'd drive it around, you'd find some mistakes with it, you'd bring it in for a tune-up, they'd fix your car, and then you'd have a new car. Nowadays, you know, when Japanese entered the market, you know, the number of defects in a car went down dramatically to near nothing, and then it really caused everyone else to increase, you know, the quality of their cars. I just wonder, we're kind of going the other way. It's like, well, if they can release a patch, then we can release a patch, and before you know it, everyone's releasing patches. It's almost the opposite effect. It's everyone's just getting lazier and lazier. But then you have something like this, and now it's actually going to cost Activision Blizzard some serious money. You know, I mean, sure, they're going to make $1 billion off Guitar Hero 3 and the Guitar Hero franchise, but, you know, remastering these discs, printing them up, sending them out on the Wii, you know, probably a couple million there, you know, probably 10, 20, 30 million. Next up, Wii Fit comes out in Japan as number 2. Here's an interesting game. I'm actually, again, kind of looking forward to this. The Wii, you know, they're doing a great job redefining gaming, and, you know, you probably heard about this. It's a Wii Fit. It's this pad that comes with the game where you can sort of do balancing. You know, it gets you in shape. And right now, there's a huge fitness craze going on in Japan, so they're sort of tapping into that. But, you know, I'm really looking forward to this. You know, one of my best friends, he lost a ton of weight doing Dance Dance Revolution. You know, he loves Dance Dance Revolution. He does it, you know, a few hours every day. Not a few, but he does about an hour every day. And he lost a ton of weight. Here's, you know, this is great. This will get kids. And not only that, this is really good because this is now something finally, you know, you could always use against people who are like, oh, you know, video games make you lazy, blah, blah, blah. You say, well, no, look at the Wii and look at Wii Fit. You know, here's a game that's designed specifically to get you in shape. It's designed specifically to help you become more healthy. So look, it goes both ways, you know. So, you know, this is good. It's good ammunition. But what was fascinating by this article is that it came in number 2. Number 1 was Professor Layton and the Devil's Box, which sold 300,000 copies, and that's for the Nintendo DS. That is coming out. That's a new game made by, that's actually the second game of a trilogy that's made by Factor 5? Is that it? Yeah, the guys who did the Dark Cloud Saga, as well as Dragon Warrior 8, which is one of my favorite games for the PlayStation 2 last year. They, you know, great developers. And the Professor Layton, take a look at it. It comes out in February for the DS. It's a puzzle game. It's sort of anime and puzzle mixed together. That game has been doing just gangbusters monsters in Japan. But again, what I really found interesting is I'm looking at this list, and you have Assassin's Creed, which was number 8. Assassin's Creed on the Xbox 360 in Japan was number 8. That sold 40,000 units. And that's so weird. It's such a strange, it's an American-type game. It just doesn't seem like it would actually do well in Japan. But I give Eidos, I give him some kudos there, because they did an amazing job with that with their PR campaign for Assassin's Creed. I think actually it was terrible in the fact that they never told you anything about the game, and all they did was ride the goodwill that it got at E3 a few years ago. But man, they did it to perfection, and they were able to sell a game without really releasing any information about the game whatsoever, and just on the title and buzz alone. And that really is impressive, I have to say. The game itself, not so much. I think Assassin's Creed 2 will be very good, but Assassin's Creed 1 seems more like a whole bunch of concepts than a real focused game at this point, but I think the second one's going to be superb. Next up, Parappa the Rapper. The original creators are working on a new Wii-type game. I always wondered about that because, you know, Parappa the Rapper is one of the very first rhythm games ever. It was a fantastic game with really great characters. The guy who did it, his name's Rodney Allen Greenblatt. He actually lives, I don't know if he still does, but he lived in New York City. I was actually at his apartment once, way back when, like 1996. So what's that, like 11, 12 years ago? His apartment looked just like Parappa the Rapper. It was really cool, really wacky. He had two beautiful daughters. I remember that. Amazing place. And he did really cool games. He used to do a lot of Flash and Shockwave games for Nickelodeon. And I would really like to see what he can come up with. You know, Parappa the Rapper is still one of the greatest games. It has some of the best music. People still talk about it. It was, you know, it's really a legendary game. So they're coming out with a new game. It's going to be a music game for the Wii. It's the same team that did Parappa the Rapper in Japan as well. Yeah, Majesco is going to be publishing it, and at some time in late 2008. And there's no real information. It's going to be like Guitar Hero or MTV's Rock Band. So no big surprise there. And then finally, you know, we have the Jeff Gerstmann saga Fallout. There's a lot of articles on this. There's a lot of information. GameSpot put out a QA that on their site that you can check out, where they basically answer questions as to exactly what happened. And this was posted on December 5th, if you want to look at it. You know, there's a lot going on here, but, you know, they're basically saying, you know, why was Jeff fired legally? The exact reasons for his dismissal cannot be revealed. However, it stemmed from issues unrelated to any publisher or advertiser. His departure was due purely for internal reasons. So, legally, I don't think that's correct. I think unless there's a mutual NDA that was signed between Jeff and GameSpot, they could, of course, say why he was fired. They probably don't want to, or perhaps slander or other reasons. So legally, they're just not going to say anything and keep silent on it. But, you know, definitely check out this Q&A. They have a few other things here, like, did Eidos' disappointment cause Jeff to be terminated? Absolutely not. Did Eidos' disappointment of the alteration of the review text? Absolutely not. Did Eidos' disappointment lead to the video review being pulled down? Absolutely not, et cetera, et cetera. They talk about the skinning, and they said that the ad campaign just happened to run out when he was let go. You know, the thing is, I read through this Q&A, and I think this is actually truthful. I don't think there's a single thing in here that's not true. I do think the ad campaign probably ran out because it was right during the Black Friday holiday week. So it makes sense that, like, that they would run out right after that period of time. Why he was fired, you know, again, I think it was just bad timing. I think I said it last week, I believe that he was fired for internal reasons, probably power struggle of some sort. He probably had indirectly to do with this review because they did recut it. Even them in the QA say that they felt his review was negative for the score he gave it and that it did have to be adjusted. There was one thing they did talk about is that they took down the video review because there was quality issues with the audio. I don't know about that, but they did also say that there was enough footage of the game in the review and that they did increase and put more in. But long story short is we're going to be talking about this a very, very long time. It's going to totally change the editorial department of every single company. GameSpot, by the way, people are all angry and they're going crazy and they're saying, oh, boycott them. And there's all those articles about, you know, you shouldn't be paying attention to them. Yeah, but then if you take a look at like Alexa or any of these site rankings, their membership and their viewership didn't go down at all. In fact, it stayed completely level. This was pointed out by a couple of people. So, you know, a lot of people are talking about, you know, boycotting them. And yeah, this will hurt their reputation. But I think, you know, for good or for bad, GameSpot's going to come out of this completely unscathed in the long run. Hopefully, we will see a lot more accurate reviews, and maybe, just maybe, the review scores will start going down. They did this interesting graph in where they showed the average review score in the industry for game reviews is a 7. Not a 5, but a 7. You know, most other things like movies and food, actually food is even lower. The average review for food is usually like around a 3. But for movies, you know, it's like a 5, close to a 5. But, you know, in this industry, if you get a 7, it's average. And, you know, a 6, if you, you know, you're a gamer, you know, a 6 is not good. You know, a 6 is a game maybe you rent at best. And I think this game was struggling to get 6s. User reviews are much, much lower. And that was even before this whole thing came out. The user reviews were low to begin with. So, you know, maybe we'll actually start seeing accurate reviews for these games. Maybe that 7 will go down to a 6 or a 5. I hope so, because I'm sick and tired of reading reviews that are like, oh, I give this game a 9.5. And it's like, okay, I give this game a 9. And you know, realistically, okay, 9.5 is really a 9, and 9 is really an 8, and an 8.5 is really a 7. Like, you know, I guess I think we all do this in our head, that we see a review and we calculate what that number really means in terms of quality of the game. But I'm having enough of news. Let's go on to my interview with Randy Buehler.
Interview.
So next up is my interview with Randy Buehler, the Vice President of Digital Gaming at Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast were having their annual Magic the Gathering World Championships here in New York City. So I went over to the Javits Center and sat down with him. Even though I know I just had Chris Perkins on last week, where we talked about Dungeons & Dragons and the online initiative. Here we talk about Wizards of the Coast and all of their online initiatives. We talk everything about their new browser-based game, Goblins, The Uncivilized, which I've been playing. It's quite a lot of fun. Talk about their online board games and taking the Avalon Hill franchise and those games as well as others and bringing them online so you can play, you know, turn-based games on the web. Talk about Magic the Gathering version 3, which is coming out. Of course, the D&D online initiative, as well as just, you know, what Wizards is doing to really take everything they do in all aspects of gaming and put it online, and also to help make gaming a little bit more acceptable, you know, with Gleamax. I found that very fascinating, is that, you know, right now you have sort of your hardcore gamers, and now, you know, very recently, last year, you know, you're starting to see your casual gamers, and I don't know why people are like always, oh, I'm a hardcore gamer, oh, you know, they're a casual gamer, they're not a real gamer. You know what? Why, you know, you go to other countries, like if you go to Germany, it's a perfect example, or France. I went to France, and I went to a gaming site, a gaming store, and it was just filled with people. You know, it's like families, oh, college girls, surprise, you know, that are playing gaming. You know, it's like people aren't vehemently, oh, you're not a real gamer because you play this. And, you know, it's like this, all this posturing that goes in the United States, it really drives me nuts. And, you know, I think we're slowly moving towards that, but the, you know, with Gleamax and Wizards really putting all of their, you know, all their efforts and all their products online is really going to change that quite a bit. So here's my interview with Randy, and there's a bonus at the end. He actually critiques my Type 1 Magic the Gathering deck, and I'll tell you a little bit about it after the interview.
Hey, this is Gaming Steve. I'm sitting here with Randy Buehler, the Vice President of Digital Gaming at Wizards of the Coast. How are you doing today, Randy?
Doing pretty good. Happy to be talking to you.
So I have been seeing a lot of people being hired and a lot of digital initiatives going on at Wizards of the Coast. I heard there was a huge number of people hired recently. You guys launching the Alpha of Gleamax. There's Magic 3.0 coming on. We talked to Chris Perkins a little bit about D&D Insider and the huge additional initiative they're doing with 4th edition. So do you want to just kind of give a wrap-up overview of like everything that's going on with the digital initiative at Wizards right now?
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's definitely a change at the company. I mean, we're looking at a tabletop gaming industry where I think we're doing a great job of making games for the customers that we already have in the sort of tabletop strategy game. But, you know, you look at today's 15-year-old, and he's online. We just don't see as many people wandering into that core hobby store. So we recognize that, you know, nobody wants to go the way of Tower Records. I don't think we're in any danger of that. But, yeah, to really grow and thrive, we need to take the stuff that we're good at and move it online. And, you know, take care of the gamers that want to play over the internet or want to play on their PCs. So it's really almost a pivot of the company, and we're not going to leave behind tabletop by any stretch of the imagination, but we think that the growth for our company is very much digital.
And how long has this been going on? Because this is obviously a big initiative. This is something that's probably been in the works for quite a while, and now we're just starting to see, it's like an iceberg, we're just starting to see the top of it right now.
Yeah, but we started dabbling in digital. Kind of our toehold is with Magic Online. We launched that product about 5 years ago, and it's been awesome. I mean, it's been a spectacular success for us. We're extremely happy with it. It's, quite frankly, it's funding a lot of the rest of these initiatives. And so, you know, we were trying to figure out for a couple of years, what's our follow-up? What do we do next? Is it, you know, we've been working on a new version of Magic Online, but should we do more games? What happened last summer, about a year and a half ago at this point, a group of us got together, and I was kind of the evangelist, I guess, the champion for this project, and really put together this holistic project of saying we need to get community right. We need to have, you know, our website be awesome, and so Gleemax as that community pillar is really the evolution of that. We should be doing games. We should be doing editorial, and so all of these pieces kind of came together, and it's interesting that independently at approximately the same time, the Dungeons & Dragons team came up with their idea for Dungeons & Dragons Insider as the, you know, the key piece of 4th edition. So there are these two different initiatives, and then senior managers was just like, look, merge these. These are the same, this is the same thing. So those projects merged, and I became sort of the evangelist who would go try to get it funded, and spent the back half of last year getting it funded. We got it funded toward the end of the year and really hit the ground running this year. You know, we Wizards actually created a department of digital gaming that didn't used to exist. I got offered the vice presidency, and we've been off to the races.
So it was good for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of fun. It was actually hard for me to walk away from Magic. I mean, my previous job was very much all Magic the Gathering all the time. You know, I cut my teeth in the industry as a professional Magic player, and so it was a, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of fun. I love this job. It's exciting, and I mean, when else am I going to get the chance to build this new initiative? And better still, at a company like Wizards, where I fundamentally care passionately about the products and the people. So, yeah, it was hard to walk away from Magic, but it's been a lot of fun.
So let's talk a little bit about Gleemax. It's the online gaming portal. I heard some people call it almost the Facebook of gaming, or what you're trying to turn it into. It just went alpha. You know, when it was first announced, people didn't know what to make of it. It's just some weird brain. And, you know, even right now with the alpha, it's, you know, there's like blogs or some social aspects. But, you know, where do you see it going to end up?
Sure. I think that it is... It's got some elements of social networking. It's also, I mean, in a weird way, it's got some elements of a dating service. Because kind of the point is to hook up gamers with gamers, right? We really want to make it easy for people to find other people to play games with. I mean, I think that's the thing that sets us maybe a little bit apart from both some of the more mainstream digital gaming stuff that's going on and some of the social networking stuff, is that we're really trying to take care of, you know, our niche of strategy gamers. We want Gleemax to be the center of the strategy gaming universe. Whether you're playing tabletop Dungeons & Dragons, Magic the Gathering, whether you're playing online, maybe you're playing our stuff, maybe you're playing, you know, Civilization, whatever it is, if you're a strategy gamer, this is the place where you're going to find other people like you. And so that's our goal. And our alpha, we launched with, it's got a lot of blogging functionality at first. That was kind of the low-hanging fruit, and we wanted to get it out there early, even though it's rough around the edges right now. I mean, we know that. But we wanted to start that conversation and find out, you know, we've got those customers already on our website, a lot of them, so what exactly do they want, and how much social interaction? So I expect to see it continue to grow and evolve, and we'll add functionality every couple of weeks, every month or so for the next, I don't know, 6 months probably. Middle of next year, I'd like to think that it's going to be something that we're up, it's running, it's something we're proud of, it's slick, it's easy to use. I think that what you'll see over the next 6 months is just sort of a slow, steady addition of new features, polish, iterate, that sort of a thing.
Well, what makes this unique to gaming as opposed to, say, Facebook or MySpace? Like, what are the unique gaming aspects to it?
I think the problem with MySpace and Facebook is, sure, there might be 100 million people on there, but it's 100 million people that are just like the jerks from high school that you didn't want to hang out with anyway, right? The thing we're trying to do is, this is just gamers. I mean, I think that the problem with the sort of big, colossal social network is that you don't have anything in common with the other people that are on there. So with Gleemax, we're essentially hosting a conversation about games, about gaming, and so, you know, the goal is really to give people other folks like them to meet and develop friendships, not just, you know, the online friendships where I'm, you know, trash talking with this anonymous guy, but those are, you know, who that person is, right? You meet that guy in the real world. And I think that our community very much has 1 foot digital and 1 foot in the analog world, in the real world. So I think that will really set it apart. And then the conversation, led in part by the folks at Wizards of the Coast. I mean, I think that Wizards.com has a lot of content on it right now that our fans certainly seem to enjoy, whether it's a conversation about, you know, sneak peek in the creation of 4th edition or the latest Magic set. You know, a lot of what we can do by just essentially having our designers go out there and talk about what they work on at work. That's kind of a cool conversation, and that conversation is going to live and revolve around Gleamax.
Great, great. So I know one of the aspects of Gleamax is the game board portal. I mean, I'm a huge player of Brittle Gage. I can't even pronounce it. The German, right? Bretzfilweite, the German version of it. But you know, it's very hard. It's got a convoluted interface. It's in German, you know. But it does get the job done. You can play these games online. We do play a lot. But I heard, you know, it's like a little bit about the board game initiative where you're taking a lot of the classic Avalon Hill games and a few others and putting it online, so then you can now at work goof off and play board games with your friends, which is what it's made for. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure, absolutely. You got the gist of it, right? The idea is to have, let's have a nice interface, let's have an easy-to-use way, let's make sure the games work. And we've got this awesome backlog of Avalon Hill titles. I expect when we launch it, it'll be mostly Avalon Hill titles because that's the stuff that we have, but we don't want it to be just our stuff. I mean, this is true not just of the board game portal, but of Gleamax in general. Like, we're building this because we think it's the right thing to do for this sort of strategy gaming industry, but our real goal is set this up as a platform that other people can use. So, you know, if Days of Wonder wants to come in and put their board games there, if, you know, we can get the latest Reiner Knizia game to come over, we really see this as, you know, again, the hub that the board gaming community can potentially revolve around. Sure, it'll have our stuff at launch. We've already announced Axis and Allies we'll have there. Vegas Showdown, which I don't know if you played Vegas Showdown,
but I've heard about it.
It is my favorite board game right now, and not just because it's ours. I just, you know, sure, I like Ra, I like, you know, St. Petersburg, I still play some. There's a board game. The guys around the office play a bunch of board games, and most of them are German, but Vegas Showdown's in regular rotation because it's just good. I mean, I think it's a fine example of a German board game. It just happens, okay, Wizards of the Coast designed it. Robo Rally is the game we actually let the early fans of Gleamax voted what board game did they most want to see us put. They voted for Robo Rally, so that's been in. The other one we've announced is Guillotine, which is kind of a fun, little more casual, family-friendly card game that we've put together. So
we used to play that in college, except it was a drinking game. Not appropriate for this podcast, but same basic principle.
I can see it. I can totally see it. So yeah, Board Game Portal, just an example of the kind of thing we should expect to have, where when the whole thing is up and running, we'll have games, we'll have community, we'll have, you know, articles by WotC insiders. Hopefully the rest, and we're already starting to see signs of this, that, you know, the rest of the strategy game community will want to be in that conversation and want to take advantage of the tools that we're doing and the audience that will be there. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
So let's hit a few more quick topics. Goblins, the web-based game that you're coming out with. There hasn't been that much press on it. I've been playing it. I'm in the alpha, and these type of games I love personally. I love these, you know, browser-based games or multiplayer that you can go up against. You can play with your friends and sort of in group. You know, there's a lot of these. A lot of these games are there's a lot of German-based games that are very much similar to EVE Online, is that you're managing resources over time, and then after a certain amount of time you come back to it. But this is sort of a mix. This is unlike any game I've seen. It's sort of like a single player aspect to it, where you're building up your individual base, and then the second part of the game is that you and a group of people then have to take over the entire world. So it sort of switches, and it's all flash based, obviously. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that and where it's at and when you think it'll launch?
Sure. I think that for me, it's a great example of Wizards of the Coast taking what it's good at, game design, and in particular, deep strategy, complicated games where you can really dig into the rule set and figure out what's going on, and now turning our attention to the online platform. So it's turn-based strategy, but it's inherently multiplayer. And that's something that just you don't see very many people doing, turn-based multiplayer, but it's exactly what Wizards of the Coast has always done. That's what our games are. So it's been a lot of fun for us to sort of take that brain trust, take that R&D group, turn them loose, see what they can do. And this will be sort of the first example of an original digital game design coming out of the WotC brain trust. And so, as you say, it starts out kind of a sandbox game like a Civilization, where you're gathering resources and leveling up your heroes and building buildings. But then, yeah, you're part of a guild, and so you have... There's 8 different guilds in the game, and each one has a unique victory condition. So if you're in the Dragon Tamers, then your goal might be to steal a baby dragon egg and hatch the baby dragon and, you know, grow the baby dragon and convince the baby dragon that enemy goblins taste good, but we taste bad. You know, unleash the dragon, take over the world. Or, you know, the mad bombers are trying to blow up the world, and you have to build the super shield and then the quest. If only you can find the shiny red button, you know. Push the shiny red button, blow up the world, hide behind the super shield, win the game, that sort of thing. So we've had a lot of fun with the goblin humor, and I like the demonologists essentially build dungeons in order to collect corpses. Like, they need dead adventurer corpses. That's what they need to sort of fuel their ritual to open the portal to hell and win the game. So, yeah, they build dungeons, they advertise them to lure the adventurers in. It's been a lot of fun to work on. And, yeah, at this point, it's in an alpha, as you say. You know, we want to take the time to get the gameplay right, because that's something that, you know, we think that we care a lot more about gameplay and really compelling deep strategy than, you know, it's not like it's 3D graphics or animated avatars that walk around the world. That's not the thing that we think is important to gaming. That stuff looks pretty, but it's not a good game. So with this, we expect to spend many months just sort of fine-tuning and iterating, and how do we give people access to all the information they want? How do we make it easy to play? And that's kind of the... And thanks for your help with that, right?
I've been enjoying the game quite a bit. As I said, it's like... it's an interesting game. A lot of these games... It's sort of one type of gameplay or two types of gameplay, but this is, and a lot of them are kind of, you know, clones of themselves. You know, I think you play these type of games, you know, once and you're like, oh, this is great, and then you play another one, and then before you know it, you're seeing they're basically the same game. Like, one's a space game and one's a fantasy game, and they seem to be just using the same basic structure, but this one is truly unique. You know, one thing is I'm actually in two of the games, and one of them I'm playing the Dragon Tamers, and one I'm with the Mad Bombers, so it's a completely different game. You know, it's like one we're building up heroes, another one we're building up resources and, you know, taking over territory. So you can play the game multiple times and get a completely different experience. And it's a pretty long game. It seems like it's going to take several months to play before it's over.
Yeah, we set it up one turn per day. You know, that was something that we thought that'd be the right, you know, we're haggling right now. On the first day, you know, at the beginning when not much is going on, maybe you get a couple extra turns per day. But at one turn a day, we think it's a 2-month game. 2, maybe 3. It sort of depends how long it takes people to accomplish the victory conditions, and, you know, the playtesting will figure that out exactly. But it's turn-a-day strategy, and any one day you can play relatively quickly. Like, if you know what you're doing and you don't have a lot of time, hop on the website, you know, log in, boss your goblins around. You might make, you know, half a dozen moves. Might take 5-10 minutes if you know exactly what you want to do. But it's got enough depth that you can spend hours debating strategy with your teammates if you want to, right? Sort of all the depth you'd expect from a Wizards game. So we actually set as one of our design goals, make sure you can play it while you're goofing off at work, right? It's browser-based. There's nothing to install. You hop over 10 minutes, you can be done. Sorry, maybe coffee break at work. I guess that's what I'm supposed to say.
No, I think, you know what? It's a lot of my friends, you know, they're playing these games on their lunch breaks. And, you know, we play, as I said, you know, there's a place for, you know, the Xbox and the PC-based games and what you're, you know, sitting home and relaxed. But in a weird way, I almost prefer and find the browser-based casual. It's somewhere between a casual game and a hardcore game, because it's like there is real deep strategy, and you actually have to be a, quote, the gamer to really play and appreciate these games. But at the same time, you can play it in 15 minutes while you're goofing off at work. So,
yeah, I don't think the game doesn't have to be, you know, expensive or require quick thumbs to be a good game. I thought the best digital game released last year was Peggle. And have you?
Yeah, it's I know a lot of people. There's a lot of emotion with Peggle because it's like it rewards you. It's like a slot machine. It rewards you, but you don't do anything. It's a lot of luck based. I mean, there's skill, but it's like you're always being rewarded. So before you know it, it's like, oh, you win. You keep winning, and you're like, what? It's a weird game.
There's a lot of skill in Peggle. Aiming just right. My wife destroys me at this game. Like, I'm the gamer in the family, but she's just clearly better at this game than I am. I think there's a lot of subtlety and skill to figuring out the right ways to play it.
And I must be bad at the game, but it is one of those games that you can be bad at and get to the end. That's what I mean by it. It's like, you know, it's and they reward you with rainbows and stuff. It is a hardcore casual game, but the gameplay elements are pretty good. But you're not making Peggle for in goblins, nothing like that.
No. My point was just that. Not at all. My point is just that I think you. you're talking. You sound almost guilty for enjoying browser-based games. I'm like, no. What? Who's to say that we have to be playing Halo to be, you know, hardcore gamers? It's there's a lot of good, awesome gameplay out there.
I mean, a little bit of that comes from my background, since I did the browser-based games for about 10 years, and in the gaming community, there's a lot of, or at least for the video game community, there's a lot of, I would say, bias towards. Oh, yeah, you know, you did a Harry Potter game and it got 10 million downloads. Big freaking deal. I did a, you know, I did an Xbox game that sold 10,000 copies. I mean, you know, it's a weird dichotomy. It's like if you are doing a game that doesn't really have brand recognition or isn't a, you know, major release console game, it's not real. But, you know, right now, especially with Xbox Live Arcade and the recent explosion of casual games, the line is getting blurred. And I think, you know, with Gleemax and Board Game Portal and Goblins, like, it's going to just continuously get blurred until it's just gaming.
I 100% agree with you. I completely agree with you. And in fact, a lot of the you know, I sound like a marketing guy, but it's the positioning of Gleemax is, you know, our take on what matters with digital gaming. You know, we think gameplay is what counts, not fancy graphics or, you know, being on a console. So, you know, this is, I think the way we hope the conversation evolves on Gleemax is that you get this sort of mixing of genres and just find out what the good games are. And it doesn't matter what the magazines say you're supposed to care about. This is where, you know, people can come out and just talk about what they're playing and what they care about.
So let's see, I'm going through the list of items. Magic 3.0, how can I forget that? So it's funny because I've been talking to some of, you know, the Wizards Coast guys, and they almost don't want to talk about Magic because I heard through rumor and speculation that you guys are like at the max for your capacity until 3.0 comes out, and that the servers are really stressed right now, and then when 3.0 you'll have a whole new build and everything will be much better.
Right, the point of the 3.0 project was to rebuild the server infrastructure because, like I said, we launched this game 5 years ago. We didn't know how good it would be. You know, we sell booster packs at the same price as the real world, and there was some question initially, but, you know, at this point it's crystal clear that the digital object sales model works. People love to play Magic online. It's a really convenient way to play, and yeah, now we need to make sure that infrastructure can handle it. So it's kind of a weird position to be in where we haven't really advertised that game because we don't want more users right now. We want more users after we get V3 shipped and we can handle them and make sure that, you know, we can scale to grow to make that game as big as it can be. But, you know, 5 years running, it's still growing, even despite the fact that we're not really talking about it. So that's, you pretty much nailed it. Once we get V3 up and running, we'll be in a position to really grow that game and, you know, Magic at this point is about to going into its 15th year anniversary for the game in general. I honestly think Magic is the best strategy game in the world. I think it's just the blend of skill and luck is super, super compelling. And I mean, I grew up as a Magic player. I was a professional Magic player for a while. Maybe I'm biased, but, you know, I've tried playing poker, I've tried playing chess, you know, I've tried playing, you know, MMOs, and I've just never found a game that's got that awesome blend of replayability. It's skill testing, but it's fun. You know, you have to improvise, but preparation helps. So I think that Magic Online is going to be around for years and years and years, and V3 is the platform we need to just keep growing it.
Yeah, I mean, Magic is a really interesting game because it was one of the very first, the first collectible card game, and it's still probably by far the best. And it's how rare is that the very first of anything is still the best. Usually, you know, it goes through iterations, and, you know, I mean, even in the video game world, you know, it's always refined. You know, it's like, you know, EverQuest really was one of the best, and then World of Warcraft was one of the best. And now I'd almost say Lord of the Rings Online in many ways has even refined World of Warcraft's strategy and marketing for MMOs. So, you know, it's this game has been around for 15 years, and it is solid in every way, shape, and form. The only thing is make sure the cards don't break the game like Fallen Empires did.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why you've seen Wizards R&D hire a lot of people off the Pro Tour. I mean, myself included, that's really been the strategy. And I think that if you look at the Invasion was the first set I worked on. And the first thing, you know, Wizards made a concerted effort to hire off the Pro Tour. And ever since, you know, we've had to ban the occasional card, but it's really been I think R&D's on a pretty good role of making the cards interesting, producing new and powerful cards without really breaking the game.
So I'll talk a little bit about the Dungeons & Dragons initiative, Insider. We talked a lot about Chris Perkins about it, but it seems, I mean, a lot of this is very complex. Gleemax is complex, Magic 3.0 is complex, the Board Game Portal is complex, but D&D Online, or the Insider, the virtual table, that has got to be probably, of them all, one of the most, if not the most complex, it seems, because there's just so much going on. You don't have to have the whole rule set, but you have to have the 3D table, you have to have the networking features, the ability for people to pick up games, the voice chat. It just seems like a monumental task. Is it going to be ready in time for August?
Yeah, June. I mean, June's when the books launch. So the three books, Player's Handbook, Monster Manual, and Dungeon Master's Guide, they all come out in June, and we absolutely expect to have the gaming table available, ready for people to start using as soon as fourth edition hits the shelves.
I mean, how's it going? Because we saw it at Gen Con, and then it's been very quiet since.
It looks better now. I mean, I'm not the guy in charge of the PR plan for that, but I get to see the builds that come in because it's my digital gaming department that is, you know, working with the vendor to get that stuff built, and God, it looks good. Every time I see it, I'm more excited about the project. We've got the voice chat wired in now. You know, we've got the interface set up where you can go find the miniatures you need to put on the table. We've got the dungeon tile builder built and essentially done at this point. You know, dice roller. It's coming together. I mean, there's still... We need to do polish and iteration, and not all the pieces are built yet, but I feel like we're on track. Absolutely, we're on track. And I'm more excited about it now than I was at Gen Con, and I was pretty friggin' excited at Gen Con.
I mean, I'm curious right now at Wizards, it seems like there's like three major driving forces. There's, Magic Gathering, where it's a core, competency. You have, obviously, Dungeons & Dragons, now this online initiative. Do all three get along? It seems like you all sort of had the same ideas at the same time. It's like almost they were in separate worlds, in a way, Dungeons & Dragons did what they did, Magic kind of did what they did. But now you guys are going to all join together and work together in one big, happy family.
Absolutely. That's my job. That's why Wizards created a department of digital gaming, so that essentially you've got one vice president who owns all of those. I mean, for Dungeons & Dragons, we're of course working with the Dungeons & Dragons team that's producing the books and dealing with the analog aspects of the game, and with Magic, we're working with the Magic team, but it's essentially my job to make sure that it's one coherent digital front, and that's what everybody at the company wants. I mean, everybody recognizes that we've got these awesome games, you know, we've got this awesome company, we just need to play on this other platform, right? You know, there were gamers 50 years ago, they weren't playing Wizards of the Coast games. Wizards didn't exist. There will be gamers 50 years from now. They're just going to be playing on different platforms. So, you know, that accomplishing that pivot is my job. And I don't see any real conflicts. I mean, it's all of it requires the same back-end server infrastructure. So essentially, we just need to get the platform built once, get that right, and then it sets us up to do everything we want to do.
So are you going to be able to play Magic the Gathering in Dungeons & Dragons?
I'm sorry,
Are you going to be able to play the Magic the Gathering online via 3.0 while you're playing the D&D Insider virtual table?
Yeah, I mean, those two games in particular are different applications that you have to install, so absolutely you can run them together. Here's the dream. Like, the dream is, once we're done, now this is not going to happen in the next year, I'm hesitant to even say it out loud, but eventually what I want you to be able to do is trade your Dungeons & Dragons Beholder miniature online for a Sarah Angel. That not only are the games integrated with the same Gleemax social network, but the digital objects can be traded across games. That's where we're going. I mean, it'll take us a while to get there, but that's the vision for where we'll be, 2009.
So with something else that's digital related, you guys yesterday announced a partnership with Stainless Steel Games. What is going on with that? Because they said, you guys are working on something major. And everyone's putting two and two together. It's like, well, that was announced during the Magic World Championships, and they do console games. So what's going on with that?
I can't say much more than what was in the press release, right? Stainless Games has been doing a lot of Xbox Live Arcade games lately. You know, we've got a partnership with them, and they seem like really good guys. I mean, we've been working that deal out for a couple of months now, and pretty excited to be working with them. So, there'll be more. I'm sure you can come ask me some more questions a couple months down the road. We'll have a little more to say about it.
All right. Well, you know what? I have one thing I'm going to ask from you. I'm a total geek. So I used to be a hardcore Magic the Gathering player, and since you're one of the greatest in the world, I actually have my original Category 1 deck with me. I actually stopped playing when Fallen Empires came out, so I just wanted to see what you thought of this deck here.
I like the first card, Black Lotus. Best card in the history of the game. Full set of power. Nice. The force fields. Been a while since I've seen those. Urnim Jin, fine man. Serendib, still probably one of the best creatures in the game. We reprinted Kurt Abe. That guy came back.
Oh, really?
He's really powerful, but we brought him back for a couple years. He got another run.
Yeah, I mean, this was what I called my deck of pain, because it did a huge amount of damage to a very quick, you know, big monsters, but almost everything within the deck would cause me damage, and usually I would take about 9 to 10, 11 damage per game before I would kill someone else, but it was an extremely fast deck.
Yeah, I mean, the only point of damage that matters is the last one.
Right.
No, this is I would have called this a zoo deck. I don't know. What'd you call it?
We called that, well, you know, back then it was my deck of pain, because every turn I'd be taking like 2 to 3 points of damage to myself.
No, this is solid. I mean, it's aggressive creatures, Ernie's, Kurt Apes, and Serendibs. You got the acceleration. You got some counter spells. I like it. No, this is fine. I actually play, people still play with these cards, like type ones. It's almost like the kid in the candy store. Like, you play a lot of type 1, you start to get a stomach ache because you can't handle that much chocolate, that much sugar all at the same time. But still, playing with these cards, the Lotuses and the Moxes, you can just feel this power coursing through your veins. It's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we started out. I mean, you can even see, like, this is the beta. I mean, this was stuff. I actually bought this back in Pittsburgh at Phantom of the Attic is when I first started out playing way back when. And never got rid of the deck. You know, all my friends sold theirs. But I'm like, yeah, I'll keep it around, give it to my kids one day. So when it's like the 30th anniversary, then they can come in with this deck. We're like, what's a 15-year-old kid doing with like a full set of power and a Black Lotus and and dual lands, like 15 dual lands? What the heck's going on?
Yeah, it's a pretty good investment not selling this. You know how much this deck's worth at this point?
Now, how much is it worth?
I mean, this Betamox Emerald is probably worth $1,000.
Okay.
You know, this Lotus is worth most of $1,000. You know, the Moxes are probably $300 a piece. You know, this deck's easily $3,000-$4,000, I would think.
Oh, I feel like I'm on Antique Roadshow here.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice minty Arabian Nights City of Brass. Your Ernies are black bordered from Arabian Nights. This is a fine piece of magic history here.
Well, they call me Gaming Steve for a reason.
You earned some street credibility with me.
Oh, thanks, bud. Yeah, no, I was just talking. I called up my friend when I was here, and I was saying, telling him where I am. And it's funny, like, you know, he just turned 40, and he's saying, you know, we're saying, it's like, you know what, we just loved playing Magic. You know, it's like we wish we could play it more. But you know, now with things like Gleamax, that's why I'm actually so interested in this. It's like, you know, we have kids, we have responsibilities, we have these weird things called jobs. You know, it's like, it's just we don't have the time to spend every single weekend to play all day tournaments. But now, you know, it's getting easier and easier through technology that we'll be able to maybe actually start playing Magic the Gathering again, you know, and with our friends, and find new people to play with, and in a casual atmosphere as opposed to some cutthroat nasty tournament atmosphere we used to be so used to.
Honestly, I think that's the biggest lesson we've learned from Magic Online. In 5 years with that game, what we've discovered is that the Magic Online player is significantly older than the paper Magic player. And what's going on is, just like you say, you graduate college, you get a wife and a kid and a job, and you can't go down to the store, you can't go back to campus, but you know, 10 o'clock at night after your kid goes to bed, you just want to hop on and play for a couple hours. And Magic Online sets up exactly that. So you could go absolutely play Magic right now, and you know, give me another 6 months, you'll be able to play Axis and Allies, you'll be able to play Dungeons and Dragons. We really want to take all those awesome games and now take advantage of technology and make it convenient. Make it so that you can play 11 o'clock after your kid's gone down for the day. And so, you know, guys like us can keep playing the games we love.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks a lot, Rand. Do you have any closing comments on the digital game space?
Nah, I mean, this was fun. I think it's going to be a much more interesting space now that we're in it.
Yeah, I'll make sure to talk to you again at Gen Con, because I'm sure you're going to have a lot more to talk about then when things start launching.
Sounds good. I'll see you then.
All right. Thanks a lot, Randy.
So again, thank you very much, Randy, for that interview. Hopefully I'll be able to catch up with you at Gen Con this year, which I thought, by the way, Gen Con compared to E3, I went to every single E3 except last year, and I loved E3. I had a ball there, but Gen Con beat it by a mile. I went this year to Gen Con for my very first time, and there was just no comparison. E3 is a lot of fun, but Gen Con was just nothing but fun. You know, it was playing board games and playing role-playing games 24 hours a day, every day. You know, I would be walking down the hall of the convention center. It'd be 1 a.m, and there'd be hundreds of people playing games of every type and shape. And, you know, I'd be getting up at 8 a.m. to play D&D, and I'd be playing board games. It was great. And those of you who are curious, because Randy didn't really say what my deck was, here's my type 1 deck for those who are into Magic. I have a Black Lotus. I have all 5 Moxes, including a Beta Mox Emerald. I then have 4 Aranim Djinns. Then have 4 Serendipa Freets. Have 3 Birds of Paradise. Have 4 Kurt Apes.
Four lightning bolts, strip mine, a bayou, two volcanic islands, some dual lands here, all dual lands actually, four taigas, let's see, four tropical islands. I then have three cities of brass, or cities of pain as I call them. Power sink, let's see, I have four power sinks. I got two force fields, and ancestral recall, of course, time walk, of course, demonic tutor, of course, soul ring, regrowth, disintegrate, let's see, four counter spells, and three tranquilities. So that was my deck of pain, as I used to call it, because it would cause you, bringing out a lot of these creatures would actually cause you as much pain to yourself as it did the other player. But it was fast. It was a very fast deck, and I won quite a bit of tournaments using this deck. Not as good as my friend's Atog deck. Same guy at Blizzard, who I talk about, John Stats, who was on my show about a year ago, who used to just decimate and win practically every tournament he ever entered. But it is still a pretty good deck, I feel. Next up is a retro review. I'm going to talk about Coltsep for the PlayStation 2. Terrible title, I know, but if you like Magic the Gathering, this is a great game for you.
Gaming Steve's Retro Review.
So my retro review this week is Coltsep for the PlayStation 2. Terrible name, I know, but it is a collectible card game for the PlayStation 2 that combines sort of Magic the Gathering with Monopoly. It's sort of a weird beast. I can see why this game didn't do so great when it first came out. You know, it's, you know, back then, it came out, let's see, December 8th, 2003, on my birthday, no less, a little more than 4 years ago to the day. And a new version, Coltsep Saga, is coming out for the Xbox 360 on February 5th, 2008. If you want to try this game out immediately, you can go to Xbox Live and download the demo and give it a try. Unfortunately, it has a versus mode, but I don't think you can play it online. You can only play against the computer, so you don't get the full flavor of the game. But you can get, you know, you can see what the game is like and how it plays. But you do start out with kind of a limited deck, so you don't see the full power of the game. But it is a really good game. If you like Carcassonne, or if you like Catan, or if you like collectible card games, or if you like Magic, you will probably like this game quite a bit. And I think this game is going to do a lot better on the Xbox 360 because you can play over the internet against other people. And it is a board game. It is, you know, a game that is meant to be played against other people. The game itself is, as I said, pretty simple. You have different type of boards. The boards have different types of squares on them. You have like a fire square, an earth square, water square, and an air square, you know, your standard, and then these neutral squares. You then go around on the board. You can summon creatures from your hand and have them guard the squares. And then if your opponent lands on the squares, they either have to pay you rent for landing on the squares, just like Monopoly, or they can attack your square with their monster and try to take it over. And over time, you can increase the power of the squares. You can actually change the square types. You can add value to the square, increasing the rent. So if people land on it, they have to pay you more. It sounds really weird, but it plays really well. The computer is pretty tough, too. That's one of the nice things about the game. So even if you don't have anyone to play it with, especially in the PlayStation 2 version, Coltsep, the original version, you know, you can only play it with other people if you're in the same room with them. But the game does a really good job of hiding your actions. So, you know, if you're in combat, you have no idea what the other person selected. They did a very, very good job with the interface, at least that aspect of the interface. There's other items that could have done it a little better. But the game itself is pretty deep. There's 450 cards. You really have to do some serious deck building if you want to make a nice deck. Because the cards, as you play, you'll get new cards, rarer cards. And the cards really are interesting in their, you know, unique power uses. So you get your standard, you know, monsters that you summon to monsters that have all these special powers and abilities depending upon what else is on the board. And it really, you know, makes for very complex play. This game is monster hit in Japan. It does very, very well. So I'm kind of curious that they're coming out with this game on the Xbox 360 and the Nintendo DS. This game is perfect in Nintendo DS. I don't know if it's coming out. They said there's no announcement for the United States if it's coming out for the DS. If it is, look for it, you know, probably in 2009 at this point. But the Xbox 360 version is coming out in just 2 months from now. And I'm going to get it. I can't wait to give it a try. I have a lot of fun with the PlayStation 2 version, but I really want to start playing with some human beings instead of just a machine. So take a look at it, Colt Sepp. You can find it. If you're lucky, I got it at GameStop. I got a used copy for $6.99. All right, there's a lot of gaming in there for $6.99. But give this, you know, give the demo a try. It might not be your cup of tea. It's kind of slow going. I think Joystick said that when they tried to play it, that it was like watching paint dry, or you know, opening up a Windows blind store when they were playing this game. They were so bored. But you know, it is a board game. You know, it's a board game with collectible card elements. So it's not action packed. You have to sit down and really think, you know, if you want to play something like this. But the game is very well balanced and it's a lot of fun. So I would definitely check it out, Colt Sepp, for the PlayStation 2. Next, we have the Name That Game contest. Continuing last week's contest, I'm not going to poll the names just yet. If you, anyone who didn't listen to it, the contest is as follows. Normally, I would play a game, and you would have to tell me what it is. I would just play some sound, and then you would win a prize. But since I've been away for a little while, and I wanted to really celebrate and give everyone a really great prize, what I'm doing is later this month, I'm going to randomly select. People ask me how I'm going to do this. I'm going to randomly select three people. And they're going to win in order. Is third place is that they're going to win some free gaming swag. I actually got a whole bunch of new stuff, and I'll send you a nice little care package. Second prize is you'll get a free console game, $60 or less, you know, no like Rockstar or anything like that. And by the way, some people ask me what happens if you live in Europe, because $60 won't buy you anything in Europe because the dollar stinks. That's fine, no problem. You know, if you use Amazon over there, like Amazon UK or something, I'm just going to get the game for you that way and ship it to you direct. So don't worry about that. The conversion will all work out, or Australia or some crazy country you live in where it might cost $100 for me, but that's fine. And then finally, the grand prize is a free console. That's right, a free console for, you know, whether it's a Nintendo Wii or an Xbox 360 or a PlayStation 3, or if you want a PSP or a DS, that's fine. Again, if you leave overseas, we'll work something out. I don't want to worry about it. Obviously, if you want a Wii, it might take a little bit longer for you to get it, since I do not have any magic and I don't know where you live, so I can't pre-buy the Wii. Because if you live somewhere that doesn't accept US plugs, that won't work. So all you need to do to enter is send me what was your favorite game of 2007 and why? And send it to game@gamingsteve.com, the email address game@gamingsteve.com. And oh yeah, the other thing you have to do is you have to join the Gaming Steve forums. And if you're not a member already, just go and join. It's really easy. I've got, you know, it's a great forum, tons of people there, nearly 500,000 posts, probably the best of, no, not probably, the best Spore forum on Earth, if you want to know about Spore. Great role-playing section over there if you're into forum games, things like that. It's really great. A lot of very friendly people. People have been on the board since day one with nearly, oh, I think we're over 15,000 posts for a single person at this stage. But definitely check it out. Just, you know, register. So you send to me game@gamingsteve.com, your forum name. What was your favorite game of 2007 and why? And I have to say, maybe it's because the prize is so big. People are writing me very long and detailed reasons why they like the game that they select, which is great. I love that. It is going to be random, but I'm really enjoying reading these things because people aren't just saying, oh, yeah, I liked Portal and my name is this. Thanks. No, people are going on. They're explaining in detail why they like these games. And I really should have made this in the comments. I wish these were all in the comments so you can see what everyone was saying, because they're really, really well thought out. This is it's really fascinating. I'm going to try to take everyone's emails and post them somewhere, but to be honest, there's so many of them right now, it might take me a little while. So anyhow, listen to future shows. I will select them soon, and right now I'm going to go to Show Mail. So once again, here I'm at ShowMail, where I will answer your questions, anything game-related. You can send me your audio questions at game@gamingsteve.com. If you send me something in audio, I will 99.999% answer it. Just try to keep it under 30 seconds, please, or there around. Otherwise, you can just email me your text question, and I will answer it. So with that, let's get to the first question.
Hey, I was wondering if you think 2008 is the year for Duke Nukem Forever. Also, what are your thoughts on DNF, as it is poised to be absolutely amazing in every way, shape, and form? That'll be all. Have a good one.
So, Patrick, you were asking me if Duke Nukem Forever is going to be coming out in 2008. I have no idea. I don't think so. I could be wrong, but, you know, Duke Nukem, I kind of lost interest in that franchise a while ago. I mean, that is such an old franchise at this point. It would almost be better for them just to stay low, keep quiet for another couple of years, let everyone forget about it, because people who might have even played that game, I mean, that game's over 10 years old now, I believe. I think it just had its 10th anniversary. Now, so if you were 10 years old when that game came out, you're now 20, and you maybe never even played it originally. So you wait a few more years, and people will have actually aged past the original game. So it's so old, it becomes new again. But, you know, 3D Realms, they have a ton of money. So they can take their time with this. Prey went through the exact same trouble that this game went through, and Prey was a gigantic hit. You know, people did make fun of it, saying, oh, you know, the game was supposed to come out, but because the game was pretty darn good and it really had a fantastic opening sequence, and that's key to one of these games. You really have to have a strong opening sequence. The, you know, people really gave it some slack and the game did great. So I think Duke Nukem will come out. I think it would be very smart if they renamed it or even made fun of themselves a little. But they should just, you know, they should just ignore it. They should just come out with the game, you know, just ignore all the bad publicity and hopefully come out with a real solid game. Or, you know, do nothing with it. At this point, you know, I really have kind of stopped following it. And I can only imagine people working on this game must be beyond burned out at this stage. So, sorry I don't have a definitive answer for you, but it has disappeared from the face of this planet, and that is never a good sign. Thanks. Next, I have a question from Rob. He wrote me, here's a question for your podcast, Steve. Why do games on the Wii always use the remote nunchuck configuration? Mainly, I'm thinking of DDR Hottest Party and the planned release of Samba de Amigo. Which actually I do own on the place on the Dreamcast. Great game. That's me, by the way. I'm a big guy with an arm span greater than the nunchuck cord. It seems that games like DDR and Samba that the arm motions should be less encumbered. The obvious way to achieve this is with two remotes. It would be best configuration for Samba in the event you wanted to put special maraca attachments to the controls. I'm suspecting a licensing requirement for multiplayer games. Is this the case? Thanks, Rob. So long story short is why do you have to use the nunchuck and Wii remote instead of just using two Wii remotes? Well, first of all, because your arm span is short, they are coming out with a wireless nunchuck, so you'll be able to, you know, be able to use that one in the near future. So that will help you out. There was a couple of articles about this this last week about that. So look for that. But the main reason is that, you know, Nintendo wants to conform to a standard setup. And not even Nintendo. It's that Nintendo and their partners, anyone of these publishers, you know, they don't want to make it that you have to have two Wii remotes. And what happens if you make it multiplayer? Then you're going to have four Wii remotes. You know, that's not a standard setup. That's really unfair. It's going to get a lot of bad press because of something like that. You know, it's just bad precedent. They've done this before. You know, they've come out with games. Remember back for the GameCube days where they had games that you had to link your place or your Game Boy to. And, you know, there was all these convoluted ways. And, you know, every one of these weird ways failed. You know, you just don't want to make the barrier to entry any harder than necessary. And if you need two remotes, like Samba is a perfect example, because you do. You need two remotes, one for each hand, you know, just even using the trigger, if it's going to be on the nunchuck, to, like, you know, trigger, you know, special shakes, you know, they're going to just go with the standard setup. You know, people already have a wireless nunchuck with their, you know, remote, most likely, their Wiimote. I myself, for instance, I only have one nunchuck. I have two remotes, but I only have one nunchuck right now because a lot of the games I do play with multiplayer, you know, Wii Sports and such, you only need to have, or Zach and Wiki, you only need to have the remote and that's it. So, you know, that's part of it. I bet you there is something Nintendo also enforces so that, you know, they try to make it so that people use these standard configurations. So that's why, but, you know, in the short term, just get the wireless nunchuck, which is coming out in a few weeks/months, and that will help you out. And as people get better and better with this system, you're going to see people, you know, really get refined with how the remote and the nunchuck work together. a good example is the DS. You know, the first couple of DS games were just crap. I mean, they were terrible with the stylus. They didn't even figure out how to use it. But now, you know, you're starting to see games that are really using the Wii remote and the Nunchuk really well and in innovative ways. You know, take a look at, you know, Super Mario, the new Super Mario game, or, as I said, Zack and Wiki, that does a really good job of using the Wii remote in unique ways. Next is, let's see, I have this one. This is a great email. Dear Steve, I've been a long-time fan of your podcast. Keep up the awesome reporting. Recently, I was ripped away from the love of my life, the fleshy kind, not made of silicon. Being in the Navy tends to happen to a lot of people. I was wondering if you could toss me a list, preferably as big as possible, of online games we can play together. Obviously, there's going to be the usual mainstream MMOs, but I'm looking for more. Thanks, Steve. So, Steve in the Navy, I feel for you, and I completely understand. I'm not completely sure which type of games you want to play with your loved one, so I put together a nice little list of different types of games you can play. For your standard MMO, you know, of course you have your World of Warcrafts and such, but I would probably recommend two that I think would work out really well. First is Lord of the Rings Online. I've been playing this quite a bit, played actually pretty much every single night, but having a very good time with this game. And what I really like about this game is that it's fairly quick, that you can, you know, it's fairly easy to get around to the game. So if you want to hook up with your loved one while you're playing at the same time, you can quest together pretty easily. There's also a very large range allowability between questing. You know, you can be level 25, they could be level 20, and you can easily quest together. You know, World of Warcraft, it's really, if you're more than two levels apart, it's pretty hard to, you know, it's really hard to quest together. But Lord of the Rings Online really is well designed for large groups, or actually small groups, which is nice. And then finally, Lord of the Rings Online is a nice game because you can play it 100 different ways. They really do a good job. If you just want to go on and do some questing, you can do that. If you want to go on and just you know, grind, it actually rewards you for grinding. You can do that and sort of increase your character abilities. If you want to just, you know, craft, you can do that. You know, there's a lot of different ways to play this game, and you get rewarded at everything you do. So I'm really finding this an excellent, excellent game. And right now they're having a special. I think it's like $9 for Christmas season for the first month, or $10, I think. They've been promoting it. Another really good game is City of Heroes. And I'm picking these type of games because I imagine there might be a level discrepancy between you. You know, it's a hard thing if you're doing an MMO, is that you really have to be very close to one another. But City of Heroes and City of Villains has the sidekick system, which, you know, I don't know why other people don't do this. You know, you can be level 40 and your friend can be level 15, and it doesn't matter. You can sidekick them, they get bumped up right up to your level, and then you can go do your quest together. And also, quite frankly, it's a fun game. You know, City of Heroes, City of Villains, it's not quite as big as it used to be, but it is a fun game. Who doesn't like to be a superhero? There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of great quests in the game. It's has a good community. I would check that one out. So that's for, you know, playing together over the PC. I don't believe you had an Xbox. I wrote you real quick, and you said you didn't really have a console. But the other PC-type games I would recommend is browser-based, turn-based games. I actually play a lot of these. I really enjoy them. And the nice thing about it is because they're turn-based, you know, you can take a turn, she can take a turn, you go back and forth. Two places I really recommend is littlegolem.net. It's Little Golem. It's littlegolem.net. And they have a lot of games on there. They have Go, Chess, Ravigi. There's a game on there called Street Soccer, which is actually a board game. I play that a lot. They have everything from playing against other people, your friends, random people. There's mini tournaments where you can play a tournament with like four or five people. And then they have these big, massive tournaments where they have, you know, they're ranked and you can get actually placed in different levels, and you play, you know, against like 25 other people at once. So there's a lot of fun games on there. I've been playing on that site for several years. I only play street soccer, but it's a great game. And what I also like is they use the chess ranking system, so you can actually see how good you are getting at these games. And it's really, it's a thrill once you start getting, you know, really highly ranked, and you can actually see your progress. And then another one that I really enjoy a lot is SpiegelByWeb.com. It's I'll spell it. It's S-P-I-E-L, Spiegel, and then B-Y, W-E-B, so .com, so Spiegel by Web. And it is a, you know, there's online board games you can play there. And again, they're turn-based. They have things like Hoity Toity, Tikal, Wallenstein, Reef Encounter, Hacienda, Bus. My personal favorite is Tikal. Tikal. It's a very, it's a fun game. It's good with two people. It's pretty fast. And that's a great place to go online and play games. And another place you should go is BoardGameGeek.com. They have lists. The site's a little confusing, but they do have lists online of like every single type of board game and type of turn-based game you can play. They even have a few on their own site. And also DaysOfWonder.com also has board games you can play on there against other people. And that's in real time, too. One that I featured on the site a couple of, I think it was over a year ago, is Ticket to Ride, which is a great, great board game, very easy to play. You can play it live against your loved one. It's a pretty quick game. It's anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour. And you can buy that, and she can buy that, and you can play against each other or with other friends. And it's like $20. So hopefully that will help you out. Lots of different ways to play. And good luck to you, Steve. And last but not least, let's see, I got one more after this, is, hey, Gaming Steve, I remember reading somewhere that only 5% of games released will make a profit. Is this true? If not, can you tell me what you think the correct percentage is? Thanks a lot, Nicholas. Nicholas, so I think I'm the one who said that, because it was true at the time, is that very few games will make a true profit. Now, it gets a little tricky. What I meant by that is because the publishers usually will make a profit because they get paid first. You know, a developer might make a game, for instance, like the publisher will say, okay, this game is going to cost $1 million to make. So what they'll do is that they'll give the developer $1 million to make the game, and then they'll release it. But then for every game that's sold, the publisher gets paid first. And only after they recoup their losses, after they recoup that $1 million and a little bit more, and marketing costs and all that stuff, so maybe after they recoup $2 million and actually make a little bit of money, then they start paying off the actual developer of the game. So depending upon you look at it, the developers, you know, they really have to sell a game and come up with a hugely successful game for them to start seeing money. But the publishers themselves, you know, they can sell less of a game and actually make money, or at least break even. But really, it's a numbers game like Hollywood. You just want to come out with as many games as possible at sensible price points, anywhere from your really big monster, you know, event-type games like Mass Effect and Halo that you can dump tons of money into development costs and PR costs, to your very small games like Puzzle Quest is a perfect example of, like, you know, it's a small game that was developed by a pretty small team, and that game has really taken off and has legs. So you really, you know, you don't know where it's always going to come, where the money's going to come from. But as for the percentage of how much people actually make games, depends. Depends how you look at it. Depends who you're talking to, and it depends what platform you're on. You know, every single system is completely different. Now there's browser-based games that, you know, can make money. Now there's the casual gaming market. You know, there's the Xbox Live, which is totally different than Xbox and console games. You know, there's the DS market, where they make very small amount of money on every single cartridge sold. You know, Nintendo makes money on everything. So depending on how you look at it, it can be anywhere from, I'd say, 25% to 50% to 0%. And I know that's not the answer you're looking for, but I don't know really who you're, you know, coming from. Yeah, I would say probably the publishers, they're very smart nowadays. I'd say between 35 to 50% of their games at least break even, or come very close to breaking even. They are very smart. They have very good ways of determining how well these games are going to do at these points. They can tell just by the number of pre-orders, pretty close to exactly how much the game is going to make, just on that alone. And those numbers, for instance, I talked about Prey before. The sequel to Prey was announced before Prey even came out, because they knew just from the pre-orders that this game was going to be a big success. So, you know, again, they're very sophisticated. The tracking and reporting features that are out nowadays that weren't out as little as 5 years ago, you know, allow, you know, the publishers to really get a true feel for how the game is going to come out. And also, you know, how much money they should put into the game, both marketing-wise, promotion, as well as, you know, just giving it out, I'd say, freebie copies, things like that. The only ones that can't seem to figure it out is the MMO developers. They obviously, so many MMOs go out of business. But I know that's not exactly the answer you're looking for, but it gives you an idea of most games nowadays do pretty well, or at least break even, especially the big ones. The little ones, all over the place. And finally, I have Keith, who wrote me three questions. BioWare was bought by EA. What does that mean for BioWare fans? Does this mean we just got pawned? Or is BioWare in better shape ever since the new CEO of EA was once the CEO of BioWare? Next is Mass Effect. It's a send-up of classic 1980 sci-fi. What's your favorite sci-fi moments that are evoked by this game, Mass Effect? What other inspirations do you feel it draws from? And finally, how does BioShock fit and live up to System Shock's legacy? Welcome back, Gaming Steve. Billy Shank, the Danger Boy. I think you've written me before. So I'll answer both, all three of these, since there's three questions. I'll answer them quickly. BioWare, what do I think of it? Be honest, when I heard they were bought out, I was extremely depressed. Because I only have three other companies to name to you: Origin Systems, Bullfrog, and Westwood. Remember these great studios that used to have fantastic games? They were all bought out by EA, and you can see what happened to them. I will say one more thing, and that's Maxis, who was also bought out by BioWare, and you can see how well that turned out for them. But you know, EA, you know, they're a very business-like company. They buy market share so they can address segments of a gaming space that they might not have, access to. So they need a role-playing game segment. They need to address that portion of their portfolio, their game portfolio. So they go out and buy someone who's already been established. But I have a feeling you're going to be seeing BioWare. They can say all they want, but BioWare takes forever for their games to come out. I mean, they'll wait 4, 5, 6 years for their games to come out. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think we're going to see games coming out much, much faster, and maybe, you know, quality is going to suffer. But, you know, keep in mind, BioWare is working an MMO. It's sort of the worst-kept secret that MMO they're working on is probably a Knights of the Old Republic MMO, which I believe is true. And that alone, you know, if that game comes out, maybe they're going to make Blizzard-type money that they do on World of Warcraft. And if it's anything like Knights of the Old Republic, that is going to be very successful. But it's yet to be seen, you know. BioWare makes very, very good role-playing games, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they can make very good, massively multiplayer online role-playing games. Next up, but what do I think of Mass Effect and what I thought it drew from 1980 science fiction memories? You know what? I actually am vastly disappointed with Mass Effect. I'm going to write about that, why. It has nothing to do with the gameplay. It has a lot to do with that the game is obviously rushed. It's from a design point of view. You can see very clearly that there's a lot of elements to the game that was rushed, and that they purposely broke aspects of the game to make it play out a little bit better. A perfect example is the sniper rifle. The sniper rifle is useless. By the time it's useful, it's the end of the game. If you try to use a sniper rifle, it looks like you're drunk. You zoom in, you're moving out all over the place. That is called the compensation. That is where they put it in. They probably made it rock solid, or that it had a little bit of movement, but the game was probably way too easy using the sniper rifle. You can go and kill every single thing from far away. And on top of that, it's like, okay, you have precision, they can't see you, and you can kill them with one shot, one kill. Why not everyone use a sniper rifle, and they probably would have gotten ripped to shreds. So instead, they make the sniper rifle nearly impossible to use and limit it to just two character types. Things like that are found throughout this game and that really bother me. It's very obvious, especially if you're a developer, or I'd be curious to hear what other people who develop games for a living think when they see some of these aspects of the game, that you know what they were thinking when they developed it. But as for influence, I think it draws from Knights of the Old Republic. That was still their best game, and unfortunately, it looks like they just keep trying to rehash it over and over again. You know, they did that with... with their Kung Fu game. Of course, the name escapes me right now. I'm picturing it, but I can't remember. Then they did this also now with Mass Effect. Is that, you know, they kind of keep drawing from themselves. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but unfortunately, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to have different types of powers. they're just like force powers, and we're going to have good and bad, just like you had in KOTOR, and you're going to have your little henchmen and little group of team, and that talk to each other, just like KOTOR, and we're going to have different planets you can go to, just like KOTOR, and you're starting to see a pattern. It's maybe it's just me, but you know, the game looks like a reskinned, inferior version of Knights of the Old Republic that was rushed and was released in time for the holiday season before it was complete. And the combat system I find very disappointing. And I have more than a few friends that have completely stopped playing it because they took the wrong character build and they can't even get past some key boss battles after 100 times of trying and just gave up. And then finally, you wrote Bioshock. Once again, there's a game that's a weird one because I absolutely loved playing that game. And then after I thought about it and finished it, I thought, wow, you know what? That game was nothing more than System Shock 2, except really, really, really prettied up and really, really, really dumbed down. And it, again, made me kind of disappointed. You know, System Shock 2 was a vastly superior game and still is a vastly superior game. I do think Bioshock is an excellent game. And some of the levels, especially the, quote, the horror, I forget the exact name, the horror level, you know, sort of that scary level, is brilliant. But I'm disappointed the ending I thought was pretty poor. I thought the final boss was really bad, way too easy. I don't even think I got hit the single time I played against him. And then also the Deus Ex Machina of, oh, I don't know, never being able to die in the game. You know, it's like, wow, you can never die. That's, it was like Prey was like that, you know? It's like, okay, so you finish the game up in a few days and you're done with it. And yeah, that was a lot of fun, but in the end, it's sort of an empty experience. You need a little bit of challenge, and if you continuously die, you know, that's not really much of a challenge. They did put in a patch recently that turned off that feature if you want, but I think it's a little bit too late, and I wish they put that in originally. I would have definitely turned that off, so at least if you die, you know, you could have the option of whether or not you want to, you know, resurrect 5 seconds away from where you just died, and you could just continue like nothing ever happened. It's like a 5-second timeout. So, but, you know, it's a great game. It just, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to last with me the same way System Shock 2 did, which is unfortunate, or Deus Ex for that matter. So thanks again for your emails. If you have any questions or comments, send them to, you can send them to me, game at GamingSteve, or feedback. Well, anything really comes to me, to be honest. But those are the two, feedback at GamingSteve.com for the questions. And with that, let's get to final thoughts.
Thoughts.
So final thoughts, I've been adding a lot more, as you can see, content to the site. I'm putting together some lists now, my favorite games of the year. As you say, I'm also going to put together some my disappointments of the year, things like that. As you can see, some of the ones I'm going to probably put on a list that a lot of people are going to be shocked and upset about are things like, oh, I don't know, Mass Effect and Bioshock and, you know, other really big mainstream games, which is only weird because I think these games actually are good games. I just don't think they actually delivered as much as they promised. And then you have games like Halo 3, which interestingly is getting kind of lost in the mix. Like, it was a big hubbub and, you know, big thing going on because the Video Game Awards that was on Spike TV, Bioshock won Best Game of the Year, but not Halo 3. And it was almost because Bioshock, you know, was talked up a lot, but it still kind of came out of nowhere. And so the expectations weren't as high. But then you have Halo 3, which is a vastly, vastly superior game to Halo 2 in pretty much every aspect, and is a lot of fun. But it is, you know, it's expected, this game. You know, it's like, well, we expected this game to be fantastic and to do amazing, and it's done so well, you know, it's really not that, you know, it's almost not being rewarded for its success. You know, while a game like, oh, Bioshock, which kind of came out of nowhere, is rewarded because it was, you know, it was talked about, but it actually delivered what it was promising. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about this on the site and in general. But I tell you right now, I'm having a lot more fun playing sort of smaller more esoteric games, like even this Cold Sep I was telling about. I broke that out and started playing that. I'm also playing a lot of browser-based games with my friends, playing a lot of Lord of the Rings Online right now, even a little bit of Peggle every so often. I know that game's kind of a weird game, but it seems to be a good game to kill a few minutes, which sometimes turn into hours, but it's a good little mindless distraction. But, you know, it's like the big games. I'm almost getting event games out. You know, so how much can you play of Mass Effect and Super Mario Galaxy and Call of Duty 4? It's almost too much gaming. It's too much. It's like eating sugar all the time. It's just too much. Too much. So, anyhow, hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in next week. I will have another show. Well, hopefully next week. We'll see. Next week or two. And we will continue the contest. Don't forget to send in those entries to win the game console. And until then, I will talk to you later. See ya.
Listening to Gaming Steve. Until next week, remember to always finish him!